Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Many of us have probably never lived through something like a viral pandemic, but your grandparents might have. Before this coronavirus outbreak, the last time America faced something like what we're living through now was in 1918 during the Spanish flu. As many as one-third of the world contracted the virus, and 50 million people died. Philadelphia was one of the worst-hit cities in America because they didn't follow the kind of social distancing measures required both then and now. That's why, even as the CDC predicted something like it could come back to America a couple of years ago, the Philadelphia College of Physicians planned an exhibit to look back at the 1918 Spanish flu. Nancy Hill is the manager of the Mutter Museum, which is run by the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. She spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida.
I'm curious about the 1918 flu pandemic, and particularly the ways that local governments or even the national government have approached public health. What changed with regards to public health and how governments handle it and address it?
It certainly made that generation aware of public health as an issue, whereas previously, you know, we had had things in Philadelphia like the yellow fever epidemic. The government response to yellow fever was basically that the entire new American government just kind of left the city of Philadelphia for more open areas that was thought to help. That certainly was the response in 1918. I don't think all that much changed in the immediate aftermath. The government response in 1918, I would say, was not great, but that was largely due to the fact that the First World War was still going on, and that was considered a priority. So a lot of public health messaging didn't really make it to the general public because of concerns about patriotism supporting the war effort, as well as issues surrounding stating or letting the opposing forces know that we were compromised. There were censors on a ton of different presses, not just the American press, mostly because both sides of the conflict didn't want the other to know that they were compromised. So in terms of how it's changed since 1918, I think the biggest thing to come out of that pandemic was the flu vaccine that ultimately became available in 1945. Work on that vaccine started in earnest in 1918. They were desperate for a solution to flu pandemics.
Oh, that's very interesting. But there wasn't like a greater understanding of, like, you know, staying indoors and kind of the way that things spread? Or was that already kind of in general knowledge at the time?
Well, some of the things that the government did in 1918, and they certainly did take measures and step out with public health messaging. The name of our exhibit, That Spreads Death, actually comes from the public health campaign at the time. However, a lot of that stuff wasn't really unveiled or made, you know, communicated to the public until it was already too late, really. I mean, the Liberty Loan Parade was held in Philadelphia on September 28th of 1918, despite public health officials warning that it was a bad idea. And so by the time a lot of this public health messaging came out, which was after that parade, it was already sort of too late. You know, it was already kind of running loose in the populations in different sections of the city. There were also some measures put in place in other cities, not in Philadelphia, but in San Francisco. People were encouraged to wear gauze masks, and at certain points it was illegal to go out in public without wearing a gauze mask. They had a little rhyme about it, which was, obey the laws, wear the gauze, protect your jaws from septic paws. So that wasn't the case in Philadelphia, but other cities around the country certainly were taking preventative measures, however, given their scientific understanding and the war effort.
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of people who mention or invoke the lessons of the 1918 flu pandemic, the Spanish flu pandemic, and try to apply them to today get a lot of pushback. And they say, well, medicine has changed a lot in the last century. What are some of the lessons that are applicable, and is there enough to learn from 1918 to apply to today? I mean, it seems like messaging is one of the lessons. What else is there, despite the advances in medicine, that we could still learn from 1918?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit ill-informed to dismiss a lot of pandemic concerns, thinking, well, medicine has advanced so much, because it's really less about medical science and more about science in general. In 1918, there wasn't a microscope strong enough to discern the difference between a bacterial organism and a viral organism. So in 1918, they really didn't know what they were fighting, and some of their attempts at inoculation were for a bacterial infection and not for a viral infection. So to some extent, science is definitely on our side. We understand what we're fighting. We understand how these things spread. But I think to kind of rest on the laurels of medicine and say medicine will take care of this for us is not true. A lot of the things that we know still require public participation. You know, you still have to really trust in scientific research. You have to invest in that research. You have to be comfortable and aware of viral surveillance, which is going on around the world. In China, for all of the shortcomings that I'm sure you've been hearing about in the media, China does have a very good viral surveillance program going on over there. And again, the other issue is vaccine compliance. Is you can kind of talk about all of the great things that medicine does and all of the things that medicine can fix, but if people are not willing to comply and get vaccines, we're still going to see viral outbreaks like this. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't encourage anyone to rest on the laurels of modern medicine, because so much of what we've learned since 1918, while valuable and amazing, does require the general public participation. So that's just as important.
Mm. Now, so you mentioned some of the public information campaigns from 1918 as one of the things that you know the government did to try to prevent the spread of the Spanish flu, and we've talked about the efficacy of that and the effectiveness of that. Some of the measures, I'm curious, because right now people are trying to resist some of the public health measures that are being imposed, and they certainly, to some people, feel like an imposition. Were those public health policies, those mandates in 1918, 1919, were they popular? Was there mass resistance to those in a kind of way that we recognize now, or did people trust their governments at the time as well?
I think people certainly trusted the government a little bit more, but largely due to, the war effort that was going on. Being unpatriotic was one of the worst things that you could be perceived as. So if you were kind of speaking against the U.S. government, obviously that would have been perceived as a bad thing for other reasons. I should say that there wasn't really a national effort or any national messaging about the flu. It was very much kind of local, city and state-based messaging. The president at the time actually caught the flu and never actually made a general public address about the pandemic.
Wow.
You know, very, very different time. Again, the war effort very much shaped a lot of the responses. And, you know, it's easy to look back on those things now and say, God, what a mistake. But when you're looking at the first major world war military conflict and the debut of gas warfare, I think it's kind of a fair thing that they maybe considered the Kaiser a bigger threat early on. I will say the public health messaging that was received, I know that there were some arrests in San Francisco once they made it illegal to go out without a mask, but a lot of that messaging didn't come out until people were already seeing their friends and neighbors dying. And so it very quickly was real to people. Locally in Philadelphia, there was a major burial crisis that resulted from this. We've been collecting stories from local families who had a relative or an ancestor who lived at the time. Overwhelmingly, the thing that we hear that stuck in people's memories were bodies piling up in the street. And so I think it was less about if the messaging was popular. I think that people knew that it was necessary because it came basically at the same time and after the virus. So people were already seeing, yes, this is necessary. My next door neighbor is dying. My mother is dying. There was a very strong kind of social code against defying the American government, largely due to the wartime conflict going on too. So I think it was a very, very different time in a lot of ways. But again, I think we have the privilege right now, and many younger people especially, a lot of this doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem possible. This is stuff that happens somewhere else, and we really are privileged to have seen things like the SARS epidemic, and it didn't really make it to North America in a large way, the way that COVID-19 is. And so part of why this messaging is unpopular, I would imagine, is because people don't recognize how necessary it is. But once we start seeing death tolls spiking, and if, you know, God forbid, it got to the point that we were having burial crisis issues, it would be, you know, that messaging would become a lot more agreeable pretty quickly, I would imagine.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Nancy Hill. She's the museum manager at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia that's associated with the College of Physicians there. Now, I wanted to ask you as well a little bit about the mutual aid and social aspects of countering the Spanish flu in 1918. A lot of people are talking now about, you know, using their 3D printers for ventilator parts or sewing together masks. Was there a kind of a social element that I imagine, you know, might have been, you know, adjacent to the war effort, First World War? Was there some sort of social effort to get prevention or medicine, or you mentioned burial of the dead, that was kind of broadly public or popular?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the silver lining on the story of the 1918 pandemic is that, you know, where a lot of local governments and the city government of Philadelphia, the system certainly fell apart pretty quickly, were overwhelmed pretty quickly. Citizens really stepped up to the plate to fill in those gaps and keep things running smoothly. So, there was actually one of the kind of more amazing stories in Philadelphia was that there was a group, it was kind of a committee that was put together, and they were, their initial purpose was to observe the war industry factories here and make sure people were being paid fairly and, you know, doing work well and the hiring processes were fair and all of that. They very quickly realized it was a better investment of their time to address the flu pandemic, and they actually took over one of the phone lines at the local Strawbridge's store and set up basically a helpline that anyone could call the Strawbridge's store and say flu, and they would be connected to someone who would try to send resources out to them to assess what was going on and try to address their needs.
What was the store?
A Strawbridge's in Clothier.
What is that?
It's a large, it was a department store.
Oh, so it's just like a regular department store. So it wasn't anything special.
Yeah, so it was one of the big fancy department stores in Center City, Philadelphia, and they had a number of telephone lines, and they allowed this citizens group to take over one of the phone lines so that local civilians who needed help could have a number to call and have someone send out resources to their respective neighborhoods.
Wow, so just having having some extra phone lines was an asset that society could use to help in the fight against the pandemic.
Yeah, so you would call Strawbridge's, you would say flu, and they would connect you to the flu line, and you would say, hey, you know, I'm in Kensington, and there's a lot of bodies in the streets, and they would say, okay, we'll send somebody out to check it out and try to get somebody out there with a reinforcing cart, things like that. We also had citizens who were volunteering their personal cars and driving as ambulances. You would get a green flag to put on your car, and you would help drive people to the hospital. There were people who were cooking for their neighborhoods and cooking for their communities if they were still well, watching their neighbors' children. And then even the seminary students, there were some seminary schools who had their classes canceled. The seminary students were basically partnered up and sent out to either collect the dead, or they were digging graves in the Catholic cemeteries. There was actually a number of temporary mass graves here in Philadelphia. Most people did get a proper burial once the city had kind of returned to normal, but it was the seminary students who were doing a lot of the physical labor to address that.
Wow. So it really was a broad popular effort at the time.
Yeah. Again, I think people were seeing that messaging about doing your part to support the war effort and, you know, buying your bonds and growing gardens and all that stuff. So I think people were in the mindset of volunteerism already. And when they, you know, pretty naturally, when they saw that there were shortcomings in their community, the struggling people were ready to step up to the plate. And I think it's great that we're seeing that today. You know, I've been seeing a lot of people throwing masks for their local hospitals. There's a number of things online where people are buying meals from small businesses that perhaps are closed to the general public or that are struggling a little bit. So buying meals for hospital staff, so you're not only feeding the hospital staff, but supporting a local business, things like that. So I will say it has been encouraging to see people trying to do as much as they can remotely. And we have the benefit of the internet now, too, which makes things much easier.
Yeah. Are you at all surprised with how... You know, I don't know if uncanny is the right word, but how things today seem to be really similar, save for the new technology, to how things were during the 1918 flu?
Yeah, I mean, so we chose this topic for an exhibit, knowing that at any point in time, you know, this is going to be up for a number of years. We knew at any point there would be something public health related in the news. We were kind of thinking that it would be Ebola. There's some antibiotic resistant syphilis strains here in Philadelphia, things like that. We were pretty surprised that there ended up being another kind of major viral epidemic. It probably shouldn't have been, just because the CDC and the WHO have been warning us that we're due for one, but I think, you know, we've all been pretty surprised by it, but there's a lot that we can take from the 1918 experience. I mean, there's a lot more that we understand now. There's a lot of effort that was put in 1918, and the people in 1918 would be very jealous of all of the tools and all the knowledge that we have now. And I think we kind of owe it to our, you know, 102-year-old counterparts to do our best to address this and to work collectively to minimize the impact of it. You know, they would have been desperate for things like the internet and viral understanding and RNA testing and things like that.
Yeah. Are there any, I don't want to say predictions, but warnings from 1918? I mean, it's the springtime right now. I understand that the 1918 flu really took off in the fall and bled into the following year. Is there anything like that that you think might help us prepare better in the year 2020, or whether it be fall in 2021?
Well, I think the most obvious thing came with the cancellation of St. Patrick's Day parades in 1918. They went ahead with that Liberty Loan parade, and within 72 hours of the parade, all 32 hospitals in Philadelphia at the time were full. So I think we're already doing well by, you know, a lot of these cities that canceled the St. Patrick's Day parade. I think the other thing that we should kind of keep in mind from that is really social distancing is going to be really important. And also staying calm. I think it's difficult to recognize that this has happened before. It's not in our living memory, but this has happened before, and we have lived through it. It's going to be difficult, and it's going to be upsetting at the lot. You know, any loss of life is upsetting. But at the same time, I know people are joking about this being the apocalypse and our apocalypse outfits being pajamas instead of something a little bit more Mad Max, right? But at the same time, this isn't the apocalypse. This is something that has affected humanity for millennia. It will continue to affect us. And it's something we've lived through before, and we will live through it this time. It's, again, not to kind of minimize the difficult times that many of us are in for, but the sky is not falling. Humanity has survived things like this before. And so do your best to kind of keep calm and, you know, take care of the people around you and do your part to keep this from spreading, but also be aware that, you know, this isn't the apocalypse by any means.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of these insights from the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again.
Nancy Hill is the museum manager at the Mutter Museum at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Their exhibit, with materials online, is called Spit Spreads Death: The Influenza Pandemic of 1918 through 1919.